right in the middle of the treasurer responding to your questions. Do you have further response, or have you any further questions?
I just had one other general question that I want to make sure the loan of $130,000 back in the September 8, 2000 was for the Oregon Qualified Tuition Savings Program, and we're now after $271,000 for the Oregon Qualified Tuition Savings Program, and I would like to have some idea of what it looks like in the future, if that could be just presented to us in some sort of a written format as to how the program is doing, how much money is and will be collected as the treasurer's percentage on that for the oversight, and then how we will be repaid and what other obligations of general funds will be committed after the $271,314 for this biennium. So if I could get some sort of a plan on that, as to how that, what that plan looks like. And incidentally, the Qualified Savings Program also, is it the same as the Oregon College Savings Program?
Yes, it is.
Used interchangeably?
Yes, it is.
Okay, all right.
And Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we'd be happy to give that to you by tomorrow, or you can have that before tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Representative Hayden.
Well, I'm a little intimidated by anybody that walks around with $50 billion in their pocket, so these questions seem a little simple. Remember, there aren't any stupid questions, I hope. But I have wondered over the 20 or so years that I follow this process where the school money goes. And I had a school board member that came in from Southern Oregon last week, and he said, if I take the number of students in the, and I don't know who should best answer this, you or finance or debt management or quality control, I don't know. But he said, if I take the number of students in the state and divide it by the available money, which is arguably $6 or $7 billion, you know, he said, I come up with $10,000 per student, but we don't get $10,000 per capita. How come? And I didn't know. Can anybody tell me? Because you touched on school finance.
Right.
So.
Right. So I opened the can of worms.
You did.
Well, that's a, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm not sure how to answer that. I haven't done that math. I don't know the number of students divided by the total pot and where all those monies go and how. I think the ADMW is around 5,500, I think, what we distribute through this formula. But I'm not sure the total pots you're talking about, if you took the total amount of school financing and divided by the number of students, what that number yields. So I'd be happy to try to get back to you on that.
Well,
I'm not trying to dodge it. I just don't know this.
I've wondered for many years, and he asked a question. If I can get an answer for him.
Sure.
Second question, and I'm trying to avoid a quarter here. 10 or 15 years ago, we used to, thank you for...
I'll loan it to you, Representative Hayden.
10 or 15 years ago, when I was first here, we used certificates of participation to buy typewriters, and now we use it for large capital investments. What's the level that's available to us? How much debt can we carry in certificates of participation? What are the up and down sides to doing that?
May I have Chuck Smith answer that specific question, but let me say that one of the reasons why I want to get the state to have a general obligation bond program with a broader mandate than we currently have is that it is the cheapest way for us to borrow, and because we don't have that, we use certificates of participation as a substitute, quite frankly. So what I'm looking at for as treasurer is to give the state another tool to help meet some of those capital needs, long-term big capital projects, and the most cost-effective way for us to do that is through a general obligation bond. The fact is, with lottery bonds basically being consumed, or the capacity possibly being consumed this session, we don't have any tool. I'm looking to get a substitute tool to help us meet that need. Chuck had talked to you specifically about the capacity size of our certificates of participation.
Okay.
Would you like that?
Yes, I would. As a fiscal conservative, I sort of like the concept of cash as you go. I know the state does have some debt, but how much debt can we assume through general obligation bonds And who sets the standards? Who says how much debt the state of Oregon can have?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, which the Treasurer is chair of and Representative Butler is a member of, is charged statutorily with the responsibility of determining volume capacity for various bond programs in the state and making that information available to the governor and the legislature. And with respect to certificates of participation, they would be grouped with general obligation bonds that are supported by the general fund. We could call these generally general fund credits. And the most recent report of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission indicates that there's probably about $2.5 billion worth of general obligation bonds, and included within that would be certificates of participation that could be available to be sold. Certificates of participation have been used extensively for capital projects in this state, building prison primarily, when I'm talking about these, as you recognized in your initial comments. They're a financing tool. They trade, they look like bonds. They're paid from general funds or other funds. The legislature has authority over the amount of issuance of certificates of participation, and this is the key sort of limiting factor. The legislature looks at and reviews the use of certificates of participation. I was going to say COPs, and it cost me a quarter. I think I did.
You all right, we'll just hedge our bet there.
That quarter was squealing that went in there.
So the true limitation is what the legislature approves. They approve all the issuance of certificates of participation every biennium, and they typically do it through three separate bills. They do it through the bonding bill. They do it through the budget of the particular agency involved. And if it's a large capital project, it'll be in the capital project bill. So the legislature looks at these things through typically three separate bills, sort of three separate views, and sets a limitation that's prudent for the state to move forward with. And that's how these are controlled.
And maybe I could add to that capacity of $2.5 billion. That is an estimate. It's a conservative estimate on our ability to leverage ourselves more. It's a policy question whether we do that. But the marketplace also limits us. I mean, we could, that's a very conservative estimate to not impinge upon our good state credit. We could leverage ourselves more and have a lower credit rating. So what I'm suggesting is that in this case, we have a capacity, and one of the things I want to do, at least get the tool in place to maybe tap that capacity for capital needs are not going to diminish in this state. They're going to continue to grow.
So our constitutional mandate to have a balanced budget is sort of a paper mandate, and if we pass a bill that increases the amount of debt, then that becomes the new limit. We don't have a balanced budget, we have debt.
Well,
and it's okay because we said it was okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I don't think that's the case.
It's a question. I don't know if it's the case or not.
No, the budget is balanced. It's constitutionally required to be balanced, and it is balanced.
Because we can pay the interest payments.
Because we can make the payments.
Just a
couple of areas, if I might say. The certificates of participation require biennial appropriations for their debt service. Because they're only issued and only one biennium is provided for, they fall within debt limitations of the state of Oregon. The Oregon State Supreme Court has ruled on this and said these things are actually obligations. Their debt service is appropriated every 2 years. Therefore, they're not outside the debt limits of the state of Oregon, and the budget can be balanced based upon that two-year period.
Okay, Madam Chair. So I've got a couple of credit cards in my pocket, maybe $100,000, $200,000 borrowing capacity. And as long as I can pay $1,000 a month and cover the interest, I can borrow up to that $100,000, and my budget is still balanced. That can't be right, because I owe a lot of money. I'm able to make the interest payments, but I couldn't pay the principal off.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I know the debate you're presenting here, which is, you know, what's the use of having debt and why do we issue bonds and why that versus cash basis. And I'll be the first to say that debt can be prudently utilized to make long-term capital investments. It's used all the time in the private sector. It's used all the time in the public sector. Cash basis is not a prudent way to go, in my opinion, on long-term capital needs. You amortize the cost of that project over time. Different taxpayers pay over it over time because they have uses of that facility over time, a bridge, a building. So you're costing it. Now, you're talking about a budget issue of should we carry, is debt part of the Balanced Budget Act of Oregon? Obviously, we constitutionally have maintained a balanced budget, and yet we've issued debt over the years. So I'm not sure, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not sure we are not violating it by issuing bonds. And it is a way in which, just as you and I finance our houses, we take a debt out, we have a mortgage, we pay for it, and I may balance my checkbook, so I might have a balanced budget. Well, arguably, yes, I can still operate, but I have obligations. And some people obviously don't have mortgages, but I do.
Another topic, Madam Chair.
And you may not want to bite this off, and if you don't want to, if nobody wants to comment on it, okay, but some years ago in 1981, the legislature removed a lot of money from the 81 or 83, removed a lot of money from the SAIF, the State Accident Insurance Fund. Oh.
All right.
I caught it.
Interests are low here.
See that? And there's a bill to do, and we paid a heavy price. We paid a heavy interest price for that. And there's a bill to do essentially the same thing again today. Would that be a prudent management of our money?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, you're talking about borrowing or taking money away from SAFE potentially and putting it in for, in this case, a rainy day fund. You know, I know we went down that path about taking money away from them in the past, and legally it didn't fly. I have similar reservations about that. To me, strategically thinking, we need to have a budget stabilization, in my opinion, in this state. And the reason for that is, from my perspective as treasurer, is one of the reasons why we don't have a better credit rating. We have a AA, which is very high, but we could potentially have a higher one. Plus, is that when you look at states around the country, we're one of the only states that doesn't have any sort of budget stabilization fund or rainy day fund, as they're sometimes called. We've heard from rating agencies that not having that combined with a very liberal initiative process creates a variable that the markets sometimes, I mean, obviously they've been patient with us, but we can have dramatic impacts on our state's finances relatively quickly and not really have any backstop. So as a policy matter, I'm here to say I support a stabilization fund. How we get there is another matter. And the SAFE fund, you know, legally is intriguing, but I couldn't say whether it would fly that standard. And I have some caution about that.
That's a good answer. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three questions that are going to bounce around through your testimony. The first one is you talked about cash management practices and that you tried to help agencies with cash management practices. Does that extend to helping them with aging accounts? I've seen the report that indicates that there are a lot of well-aged, not very well-policed-up accounts in state agencies and state government. In addition to DAS, do you as the treasurer give advice and counsel to agencies on policing up those delinquent accounts?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, perhaps I can have Darren Bond respond specifically to that, but I do know that we constantly review cash management practices with agencies to make sure that they're up to current standards.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, again, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance. I have staff that participates on the state's accounts receivable.
Been there, Linda.
States.
You misspoke.
I misspoke.
All right, we'll put it. I'm down to my last quarter.
Darren. Wow. You better get some more out.
Get some green out.
The state's accounts receivable committee that looks at those issues, we do participate on that, and we have at a high level the deputy of the finance division does participate for us. We don't set policy relative to accounts receivable management. We participate in the process, but what we do is we'll work with agencies to try to help them put in place better techniques for managing, particularly for collecting. We have automated tools they can use to collect, whether it's from other agencies or from the public.
We have the ability to go in and assess their programs and look at whether or not there are some tools that they could put in place in the financial institutions, like lockbox accounts, that may help them. That's the role we play, is to try to, is really pretty specifically related to the cash flows and how can we better help them manage the state's cash flows.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Follow-up. In the main, do you find agencies concerned about this issue and cooperative?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, I think so. I think there's a great deal of attention, and there's been a great deal of work with the Accounts Receivable Committee. There's new policies coming out from DAS that I think are pretty aggressively addressing it, and we've never seen any resistance. And again, our focus on that is somewhat more limited, and when we're involved with an agency on that, it's more tool specific than statewide policy specific on that issue.
Second question.
Johnson.
I want to go back to the discussion about the use of fiduciaries and ask a very detailed question. As far as data management, is there data management redundancy? And let me try to be specific. Is there an instance where a fiduciary might have access to state information that the state doesn't have, or is all of the information used by trustees redundant back here in Oregon, assuming the trustees are out of the state?
That's Jeff's question. Mm-hmm.
Specific to bonding trustees, you mean?
Uh-huh.
Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, was your question respecting bond programs, or are you using trustee in sort of a broader sense here?
Well, let's make it specific, bond programs.
Okay. And well, I'm trying to think of the data that comes out of trustees. Most of it's generated internally, and it has to do with payment dates, payments, bond calls, amounts, investment returns.
Let's use that data then as an example. I'm trying to get a sense of, could a scenario exist by which, let's say, a trustee on the East Coast would be in possession of data about Oregon bonds that would not be redundant here and residing either in the treasurer's office or the agency that's being served by the fiduciary? And if you can't answer it now, that's fine. Maybe I'm asking it stupidly. For me, it's a data management question.
Well, the trustees provide monthly and quarterly kind of reporting information. And as most of their information is developed internally and unique to them on repayments and so forth. The agencies overall keep records on their side to make sure in balance with the trustees, and they keep their own payment data and so forth to make sure these accounts are reconciled, so that cash is reconciled between the trustee and the agency's cash. But I guess I'm missing the point here.
And maybe the confusion is born out of my lack of understanding with the process. Let me ask you a different question. Would it be possible to see one of the contracts that exists? You said that they were reviewed with DOJ and reviewed by the Department of Justice, and that they were reviewed by the Treasurer's Office. And I would assume that individual trustee contracts exist between the state and individual trustees. Could a legislator look at one of those if I asked for one?
Sure can. We'll get you a copy.
Great. That might be instructive, and I'll just drop you a little note. Lastly, Madam Chair, my third question. The Treasurer opened the door to this one by saying that you made the comment that we might be using our bonding capacity and totally consuming it this session. As the Chief Fiscal Officer for the State of Oregon, do you have an opinion about the advisability of the legislature exhausting that bonding capacity?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I am concerned about that because again, part of my duties are to manage the state's debt, to manage it prudently. Part of that is to make sure that we don't consume, in this case, one tool will disappear. It's your call to make that judgment, and it's your call to decide how you're going to use those proceeds. But that's one of the arguments I'm making to why we need another tool to help us finance ourselves going on a go-forward basis. I have some concerns about it. And again, let me state for the record, too, and if you'd like to take the governor's budget and what he's suggesting we issue in lottery-backed bonds, which is what we're talking about, and you take the proposed baseball field of $150 million, I think it's $268 million, those two combined exceed our capacity.
Right.
So the governor's alone puts us close. That puts us over. We just couldn't do it. So, and again, what happens is, just to put a perspective, is these are long-term commitments, as Representative Hayden was describing. And once you use that capacity, it's not like you can turn on the spigot again and have money the next biennium. I mean, these are
talking about 20 years before the spigot comes back on.
In this case, I think what we're committed to, the first unhooking of lottery bonds is the West Side Light Rail, which I believe ends in 2010.
That's correct.
So that would be the first opportunity to sort of take another bite at the apple for lottery-backed bonds. Now, again, if all of a sudden we had a windfall of lottery revenues, you go to line games or something, obviously that might ramp up our capacity. But given projections where we are today, that's what the box we're in.
Thank you very much for that very candid opinion.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Hayden.
May I comment that several bills have been introduced to phase the lottery out over 10 years? So should those pass, then of course you'd be looking at a 10-year end game on that. End game, that's pretty good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to. I appreciate the excellent questions that have been asked and how they've been articulated. And I think that Treasurer. I know that Chuck and I know that Treasurer both have shared my angst in varying degrees over the borrowing. And I've expressed it to far and wide to anyone that would listen to me. I think in our last State Debt Policy Advisory Commission meeting, Chuck was kind enough to add some of the language in there that, in bold, that said, even though we may have this capacity, we don't express any desirability of doing this, of borrowing this amount as a state. That having been said, Treasurer Edwards, you touched on the budget stabilization program and the issues, and I'd kind of like to get you to help me know where we're going in the state of Oregon. I haven't visited with you privately enough to know what, as one of the key executive officers of this state, where you'd like to take us relative to the overall budget stabilization program and the other issue that weighs strongly on us, and that is heavily on us, and that's the initiative process. And finally, you've mentioned needing another potential source of revenue if we continue to go down these paths. Do you have any feel as to which way we would go if we continue down these paths? Take them any way that you'd like and figure out. Sorry to put you on
the spot. I
don't
know if this is a softball or not. Madam Chair, Representative Butler, let me just state, I think part of my job is to help look into the future, and quite frankly, one of the reasons why I ran for this office was because it has a long-term perspective, whether it's investing long-term through our pension fund, other funds that we have. As I mentioned earlier, we have a long-term perspective. We're not market timers. We try to do this for the long haul, issuing debt. We're issuing long-term commitments there. I'm very mindful of when we make those commitments that we're doing them for the right thing for the state. I have an interest in the economy. I think the college savings plan is going to be one of the long-term benefits to Oregon because it will help our citizens gain access to higher education, which is demanded more and more in the workplace. So my job, in my opinion, is to help provide some guidance, if you will, and assist you, the policymakers, and the governor in finding ways to look long-term and make strategic investments. The initiative process is an interesting variable for the state. I mean, Oregon is one of the few states in the nation that uses it very liberally, and we saw last session a large ballot measure, excuse me, last November. You can read between the lines. I mean, in my opinion, voters made some very wise decisions, and we avoided, in my opinion, some very large, potentially financially damaging measures. In the marketplace, and what I was laying there is that the market doesn't like uncertainty. The market wants certainty, and they don't care what happens in Oregon per se. They want to make sure their reputations are well maintained. So when a bond rating firm looks at the state of Oregon, they look at a variety of factors, sources of revenue, the stability of the government, how we manage our debt. In our case, we have an initiative process, and quite frankly, that's weighed on their minds about how we are able to manage ourselves as a state. The stabilization fund, I think, is a critical tool to Oregon. Ever since I got elected in 1997 to the legislature, I worked on a legislation to try to make that happen. Now you're sitting in a situation where you have less money, potentially, in which case, because we don't have a budget stabilization fund, in my opinion, we're always potentially coming to the brink. And if you look over time in your budgeting process, you're getting closer and closer every year. Your ending balances are getting smaller and smaller, which I think is, in my opinion, not probably the smartest thing to do. I mean, but that's kind of the reality of the way that we're budgeting ourselves. I guess I want to clarify for the record, Representative Butler, I'm not advocating more revenue. I'm suggesting that we have a general obligation bond as a way to issue more debt in the state if we want to capture that capacity or potentially a portion of that capacity. One way we could do it is, in my humble opinion, is to look at using some of the tobacco settlement to back some of these general obligation bonds. Again, that's a policy decision on your part, what you're going to do with the tobacco settlement. This office has an interest in sort of how we manage that money, and we're here to help you with that as well. But I'm here to say that I'd say the state of the state and the health of the state's finances is good, but I think from the treasurer's perspective, we got to continue to look long-term about how we're going to make investments, and I would argue issuing debt can be a way to stimulate the economy in many ways, and how we manage ourselves or how you manage the state budget also impacts us. So it's an important part of my job, and this is personally why I ran for this office, is to help work with you to find those opportunities to make Oregon a better place.
In all due respect, isn't the tobacco settlement money all spent up in this particular budget?
I believe that
we're there with the hold. So it can't be used for budget stabilization if we spend it at that particular point. You mentioned revenue bond, or I'm sorry, the general obligation bonds as a stabilization source.
No. What I'm suggesting is that if I understood your question about sources of money, I'm looking at the general obligation bond, a general purpose general obligation bond for the state. We don't currently have that authority to issue GOs for general purposes like prisons. In this case, I'm arguing OHSU, the governor has in his budget $10 million for debt service. I'm suggesting that the cheapest way for the state to issue those bonds would be to have us issue general obligation bonds for the state and pay it with tobacco settlement as he's earmarked. We don't have that authorization today to do that. That would be the cheapest. There are other scenarios you could pay for revenue bonds, but they'd be more expensive.
That is a segue, Madam Chair, into a question that I have relative to what our percent of debt limitations are total on general obligations of the fair market value of the assets in the state. What are the limitations relative to the general obligation bonds, revenue bonds, and certificates of participation? And then there's a number, and your office pays it, I believe. You indicated the marketplace looks for certainty. And my question is, how much does the uncertainty of Oregon's lack of budget stabilization fund and Oregon's uncertainty as a result of having wild and woolly, if you will, initiative process, there's a price that we pay, and you can put that price in terms of dollars and cents. It's the premium we pay in order to assure the marketplace that they get a high level of Moody's rating or Standard & Poor's rating. And there's a dollar amount. Can you help me with that, and then help me with the percentages of limitations on the bonds?
Madam Chairman, Representative Butler, the limitations on our general obligation bond programs are set within the Constitution, because each general obligation program has a separate constitutional amendment. From a management tool point of view, they're not particularly an effective limit. If you add up all the limitations for all the constitutional provisions to sell bonds, you'd come up with the astounding number of $33 billion.
But it's a percent, isn't it? It's percent, like 7% or something like that. If you took all the totals.
It's a percentage of true cash value, and it varies program by program.
Right.
For instance, the Department of Veterans.
If you max each of them, okay.
Yeah, if you max them all out.
It's 6.25 or 6....
No, Representative Butler, each program has a separate limitation.
Right.
For instance, Veterans Affairs has an 8% limitation.
Of the total proceeds.
Total true cash value.
Okay.
Okay. And that alone amounts to $19 billion in constitutional capacity. So when I add them all up together, the limitations come up to about 15 or 16% of true cash value. I forget the number. But the number that generates based on the most recent true cash value is $33 billion. Well, that's not a very useful number. And it's a legal number, but it's not very useful. The key is that every 2 years, the state legislature approves a maximum amount of issuance for every single bond that's sold. And that's the real key, and that's part of a management system that includes the legislature, the governor, and the treasurer. This system was put in place in 1981 and 1983 in response to the Department of Veterans Affairs problems at the time. It's worked well since then. It's helped get the state upgraded since then, and it's recognized across the nation as a good, sound management technique. So the Constitution has one set of numbers, and we obviously have to observe those, but they're astronomical.
And the percentage I was thinking of, I think it's everything except for the veterans, but the amount comes up a phenomenal amount of money, and that covers both general obligation as well as revenue bonds?
No, Representative Butler, revenue bonds have statutory limitations that are set on programs. For instance, highway user tax bonds has a statutory limitation of $138 million. Economic development bond, bank bonds, $400 million, and those are statutory. In addition to those statutory total program limitations, once again, I go back to the bonding bill, which is the sort of heart and soul of debt management in the state of Oregon. That's where the legislature approves how many bonds they want sold for each separate program every 2 years and puts it in a bill form.
And finally, she'll give you that dollar amount that we're presently spending for insurance premium to move our ratings up. I would appreciate it. That doesn't come out as a general obligation of the department. That comes out of every bond issuance, doesn't it?
The dollar amount of what happens if the state's bond rating changes? Is that the
amount that we're paying presently with the issuance of each bond as a premium, that we actually pay for insurance to move our bond rating up on each bond amount that we're borrowing.
Representative Butler, most of our bond programs are not insured. Some of our programs are insured, and we do it based on an economic analysis at the time. I'm not sure there's a cumulative number that's ever been generated, but each time we would use bond insurance to enhance the rating of those particular programs, we do an economic analysis to determine, does bond insurance make sense? If it makes sense, we use it. If it doesn't make sense, we don't use it. Our general obligation bonds are not insured, so we sell all our general obligation bonds because they're good, strong credit. They're AA credit, so they're good, strong credit. We don't use insurance. But we have programs that might be rated A1 for a high A rating, and those could use insurance if it's economically advantageous to do so. And that is a decision that we make at the time of every single sale that we would consider any program for insurance.
And that insurance comes out of the cost of the, or is within, it's folded into the cost of the bond and the bond issue.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And the last time we paid that was?
Well, I think we paid 12 basis points insurance, which is 0.12% on the total debt service of certificates of participation this spring.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayden.
Well, I want to come back to the lockbox stabilization fund for a minute. When I entered the legislature in 85, the general fund was $3.5 billion. Going back historically, I've looked back on the charts to see what was $300,000. And, of course, now it's a $12 billion general fund and other funds are totaling $30, $35 billion. And it's been my observation that no matter the administration, no matter the, this is a bipartisan thing, all the money gets spent every session. It all gets spent every time. Now, if you had a stabilization fund, which you would want to have for emergencies, for true emergencies, my concept is it would get spent every session for port projects. How would you set up a lockbox or stabilization fund? What's your concept? That would truly be spent only for emergencies. Would it require a 99% vote by the legislature or what?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, appreciate your perspective on that. I guess you know, one way, and it seems to be generally accepted, that if we did put together a stabilization fund, you'd probably go to the voters and ask them to put it in the Constitution, which then obviously, as you know, would begin to put the box together. There's been supermajority votes that you have to have, certain economic indicators, and I think if you put those in the Constitution, you're pretty much bound to those. I guess I'm a little less concerned because if you look at other states that have them, they are not seen as sort of a petty cash fund. They really are set aside. And again, the idea behind it is we would have this resource set aside to help us meet those emergencies. And again, you would have to define what those are, but economic downturn of some type could be one. And again, if you put it in the Constitution, that would be pretty strong wording about where you could move. And I would say that even an initiative that potentially, and maybe we may be still facing that with Measure 7, could be seen as devastating, if not more so than an economic downturn, potentially for the state's finances. So I think I'm not as concerned, I guess, as you may be expressing about utilizing that lockbox. I'm more concerned about we've never created one, and that's where I'm at. We need to create one.
Well, Madam Chair, well, my concern is, and I don't say that we have wasted the money that we have spent over the years. We purchased services with it, but we have spent all the money to purchase services, and I'm thinking that the stabilization fund would be spent out every session, and how would you renew it? But I want to move on to another topic where you would I want to question your philosophy or ask about your philosophy a little bit. The tobacco settlement money was intended, I think, morally, although not legally, but morally, to treat the diseases caused by the use of tobacco, emphysema, cancer, bronchitis, and so on. To use it as a general fund backfill, I think there's no moral mandate to do that, and that you say that this would be a good use of the money. Could you expand on that a little bit more?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, where I see a nexus with the Oregon Health Sciences University project is
I see a connection.
That's where I'm going. That, you know, the rest of the general fund and how the governor's put it together, I really don't want to comment on that. I think he has his rationale for that. I agree. I think tobacco cessation and education has got to be a component of that as well. In fact, I think the voters in part rejected those two measures because it didn't adequately address that. I recently read in the Wall Street Journal where many states, the slowing economy hasn't been just unique to Oregon. It's been one nationwide that many more legislatures are now tapping into the tobacco money to do what you think is more morally incomprehensible, which is to use it for general funds.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions?
I just have one more relative to this issue of the lottery-backed bonds. Treasurer Edwards, in your letter this morning to us, March 5, indicating what the treasurer in the paragraph that begins, the treasury is an agency that we can be proud of. I think the fourth sentence in says, we issued the nation's first lottery-backed bonds to build Fort and his West Side Light Rail. Let me ask this, and I know that you've got some information about it within the department, so you don't need to respond today. I don't know whether that's a good thing or not, but I would like to know how many states and the nation are borrowing against their lottery, and relatively where Oregon is on that scale. I think we were down to just three the last time we met that were borrowing against their lottery proceeds. And I'd like to know where we stand, where Oregon presently is today in relationship to those states that borrow against their lottery proceeds, if I could.
You want us to bring that back to you?
Yeah,
tomorrow?
That, sure. Yeah, that'd be fine.
Sure.
But I would like a response. Is that a good thing? Is that something we should be proud of? You were
Madam
there,
Chair, right? Representative Butler, I guess I'm on record in a letter saying yes. I think, lottery initially was looked at as for economic development, to try to stimulate the economy. In this case, one of the ways to stretch the dollars was to finance the state's portion of the West Side Light Rail with lottery-backed bonds. I think it was appropriate. It was innovative thinking, and it's paid off in my part of the world, at least living up in Portland. So, yeah, I think it was fine. I think the question that ultimately comes around to you, how much do you keep issuing debt around lottery-backed bonds? And that's where I'm starting to have a concern that we're consuming that last tool.
Just to say what Representative Jones used to say, I'm not sure how you get your cattle to market, but we don't do ours on light rail.
It might be a little confusing for the people that normally use light rail to have a bunch of cattle on there. Okay, I think if there's nothing further, we'll go ahead to Linda's presentation. Do you have anything else?
No, we've integrated it actually in all of our comments.
Okay, and we will continue tomorrow, is that correct? I think Representative Butler has asked for some things to start off for tomorrow, and so that you have a little time to, I have a question. I've looked through the history, and I know that I haven't found the answer to my question. In this document, the history of what's gone on in the Treasurer's office prior to your arrival. And one of the questions I have is, in October 29th of 96, yeah, you all remember October of
1996.
October 29th of 1996, the then Treasurer announced that he was about to enter into a lease and a solution to the thing that was much troubling me at that time. And he said it was too early to talk about it. It was about a week before the election, for his re-election, and it was to do with PAMCOR, which is the Pacific Aircraft Maintenance Corporation. At that time, there was an announcement that Port of Portland had forgiven $1.6 million in lease and $4 million in back rent to this project, which was terribly troubled. I think the Treasury Department, if I'm correct, has guarantees a $50 million bond on that project. And at that time, it was costing the public employees' retirement fund $400,000 a month. And if you can let me know tomorrow, is that still the same amount? Or nothing in the history indicates that the lease Mr. Hill proposed at that time has gone through. And if somebody would kind of let me know where we are on that. And I also heard you say, I think, this morning that there's $40 billion in the Public Employees Retirement Fund, and I know there was $40 billion there 5 years ago. Has that not increased, or is that decreasing?
We can get the number to you.
Okay.
It wasn't $40 billion 5 years ago.
Okay.
The pension fund wasn't. So.
It was stated in different meetings in which I was at.
That may have been the total amount of, I don't know. We'll get that number 5 years ago. don't want to speculate.
Anyway, we appreciate all your information this
morning.
Thank you. It's heavy-duty information. We appreciate it. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow.
All right, thank you.
And Dallas, I guess we don't have anything to say on the record about tomorrow. Are we adjourned or what?
No, ma'am, nothing for the record.
Okay. We'll hopefully finish the treasurer's office tomorrow.
Chair, are we in work session tomorrow, or are you in work session? Is that how it's...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the schedule is public hearing and possible work session. Original intent was to be able to go to work session tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Readjourned.